This episode of the Memory Palace is brought to you by Progressive. Progressive helps you compare direct auto rates from a variety of companies, so you can find a great one, even if it's not with them. Quote today at Progressive.com to find a rate that works with your budget. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations.
Support for the Memory Palace comes from Odoo. What is Odoo? Well, Odoo is an all-in-one management software with apps for every business need. Odoo has apps for CRM, accounting, sales, HR, inventory, manufacturing, and everything in between. And they're all in one easy-to-use software. And the best part about Odoo? All Odoo apps are integrated, helping you get things done faster and more efficiently. So when you think about business, think Odoo. To learn more, visit odoo.com/memory. That's odoo.com/memory.
This is the Memory Palace. I'm Nate DeMeo. 60 starlings in a wire cage sit down in the snow in a moonlit field in Central Park. Above them, the stars. You could see them back then in 1890, before the city grew too tall and too bright. A man opens the latch in the wire cage, and the starlings take flight. Not really, not at first. They take some time to stretch their wings, cooped up as they'd been in that cage for so long. Others pad about in the snow, freshly fallen that day, dig for seeds that aren't there that time of year. Others pick at fresh wounds from their time in the cage with all those beaks and talons and poking wires. But let's say they just took flight. They all did eventually. And there is poetry in flight. So, the man in the snow opened the wire cage and watched the 60 starlings, black wings speckled white like falling snow in the night, like stars over Manhattan when you could still see stars over Manhattan. Watched those birds fly skyward and starbound. The man on the ground loved poetry. He was Eugene Schifflin, an heir to the Schifflin pharmaceutical fortune. And when he wasn't doing whatever it was he did at the family business, it seemed he was thinking about Shakespeare. And that wasn't a highfalutin preoccupation, though he and his family were among the highest and falutinist of New Yorkers. Shakespeare was the thing then, a pop culture phenomenon. But the scion of some fancy family could express his fandom in ways that the riffraff could not. So Eugene Schifflin decided to recreate the world of Shakespeare's England in America, one bird at a time. There are 71 individual species of birds mentioned in Shakespeare's collected works, from the barnacled goose to the wryneck woodpecker. They are used to invoke place. They fly into and out of scenes to herald arrivals, to portend doom. The raven itself is hoarse, says Lady Macbeth, from telling her over and over that Duncan has to die. Juliet wishes that Romeo were but a bird on a string that she could pull back at her will. Entrapped men are snared sparrows, lovers are nightingales. A cormorant is the thief of time itself. A pharmaceutical executive was a man with a dream. That the new world should ring with the same bird song as Shakespeare's. And so in 1858, 12 sparrows of some Shakespearean sort were caught and packed into a crate and put on a ship and tossed on the waves for weeks and carted at great expense to his home by Madison Square Park and let out to roost in a tree by his window. And they did. They even ate some wormy pest that had been preying on the green leaves of those trees. So a great success, it seemed to Edward Schifflin and to his neighbors and other wealthy tree lovers, who then sought to save their trees' leaves through avian means and sent for foreign sparrows. And over the next 3 decades, Schifflin tried again and again to repeat his sparrow success, running down the list of Shakespearean species unknown on American soil, importing thrushes, mentioned 3 times in the plays, chaffinches, mentioned 2x, nightingales, which are a Shakespearean favorite with 30 references, and skylarks with 29. And then setting them loose in America again and again, though America seemed unwilling to take them in. They all died. Of cold, of disease, for lack of the right seed or right worms or what have you. 3 decades of failed experiments. 3 decades of birds in boxes on boats bobbing in the Atlantic. But then 60 starlings. A bird the bard mentioned just once. In Henry IV, Act 1, Scene 3, 60 starlings were sent skyward and starbound to find their way in this new land. It wasn't easy. Nearly all of those 60 died that year, unprepared as they were for the harsh northern winter, until a friendly band of Wampanoag Indians taught them to plant corn, I'm just kidding. It seems a few of them found shelter from the cold beneath the eaves of the Natural History Museum, that venerable institution, where today you can learn about the many dangers to local ecosystems, flora and fauna and agriculture from invasive species in their hall of biodiversity, but was then filled with naturalists who likely delighted in hearing this new bird song, famous as the starling was for mimicking the songs of other birds. Mozart had even taken one to live in his home, having heard it whistling one of his melodies in a shop in Vienna. And those naturalists were likely impressed by the bird's resilience, as just 5 years later, there were several colonies of starlings spread out across the city. The naturalists may have lived to see a murmuration, that most spectacular of sights, in the most poetic of terms for a massive flocking, a shadow across the sky, starlings in their multitudes moving as one. They may have lived to mourn the death of Eugene Shifflin, and had known he was the man responsible for bringing both the sparrow and the starling to North America, though his obituaries didn't mention it. But those naturalists were long dead in 1960, when tens of thousands of starlings flocked all at once at the edge of the water and got sucked up into the engines of a Lockheed Electra and sent Eastern Airlines Flight 375 into Boston Harbor, killing all 60 people on board. But their antecedents, ornithologists, agronomists, ecologists, have been here to catalog a century and a quarter's worth of environmental calamities wrought by the starling, whose range now stretches from Alaska to Guatemala, who've stolen food from native birds and animals, who've likely driven two species of woodpecker extinct, who decimate crops, who have an uncanny ability to spread diseases, both avian and human, who are one of the most destructive creatures on Earth. 60 starlings in a wire cage in 1890, 200 million in North America today. One poet with one line about a bird. This episode of The Memory Palace is written and produced by me, with engineering assistance from Elizabeth Aubert. Eliza McGraw helps with research. The show is a proud member of Radiotopia from PRX. Our ad music comes from J.D. Sampson, and I like to use this space now and then to tell you what's going on in the other corners of Radiotopia. Today, I want to point you in the direction of the newest mini-series from Radiotopia's Showcase program. It's called Space Bridge, and it is a fascinating, beautifully produced show that takes you back to the last days of the Cold War, when citizens, when astronauts and cosmonauts, ESP enthusiasts, artists, and folks from all walks of life tried to bridge the gap between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. Check Space Bridge and all the other Radiotopia shows out at radiotopia.fm. You can follow me on Twitter and Facebook at The Memory Palace. You can drop me a line to nate@thememorypalace.us. Talk to you guys again.
Radiotopia.